This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone. This is Lana. Finally, I've managed to get a Russian guest, which is difficult with the language barrier. Joining us is Anatol Kliosov. And unfortunately, not sure why, but I kept calling him Anatoly in this interview when it should be Anatol. He has an interesting background as a scientist who's known for his work in biochemistry, biomedical sciences, and his research in the field of DNA genealogy and the study of history of species through DNA molecular history. In Russia, he held one of the top scientific recognitions, being awarded the USSR State Prize in Science and Technology. He was also the first person to use what we now call the internet in the USSR, so he'll share that story. Kliosov has been prominent in the Russian mass media concerning his theories of the origin of the Slavic people and Aryans. And of course, it's controversial. And most importantly, he is one of the two scientists who published a paper called Reexamining the Out of Africa Theory and the Origin of Caucasoids in Light of DNA Genealogy. Rebecca Kahn, that is the last name of her ex-husband, is a geneticist who since the 80s has been pushing the mitochondrial Eve story, which tells us that all humans are genetically descended from a single African mother who lived 200,000 years ago. This is the foundation of the Out of Africa mythology. They claim Homo sapiens emerged in Africa relatively recently and migrated to all parts of the Earth. Although lacking substantial evidence, the Out of Africa myth is widely disseminated and pushed as truth, as it fits perfectly with the anti-white agenda. Before Out of Africa, it was Darwin to propose that all humans had in common an ancestor who lived in Africa because he thought African apes had a close evolutionary relationship with humans. Nearly all contemporary American and European scientists are proponents of the Out of Africa dogma because, as we know, if a scientist's research is not in line with the political narrative, they'll receive no funding and be ostracized. However, ancestry and genetics of different human groups is much more complicated and not so simple. We'll discuss quite a bit in this extended interview. I do not agree with everything he says as much as still in the realm of mainstream, but I will say it's extremely difficult finding scientists who are brave enough to tell the truth when it comes to human origins, evolution, race, and the history of European peoples. Anatol, coming up. Well, welcome, Anatoly. It's great to speak with a fellow Slav, and I know this is going to be interesting, so thanks for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, unfortunately, in other European countries, we're so isolated from Russia because of the language barrier, but I know there's interesting research coming out of Russia such as yours. So for those who are unaware of your work, can you tell us a bit about your background and your areas of interest?
All right. So my background is, as commonly as it happens, I was born a while ago and was born, I mean, technically it was East Germany that time because it was right after World War II, actually, a year and a half after it. And since my father was a military officer serving in the Russian army in World War II, so I was born there next to Königsberg. Then the name was changed. And then since my father continued to serve, we were moving around in the Soviet Union. In fact, I spent 10 years of my young life on the major military base, actually missile base, in the Soviet Union. And so I spent 10 years in a town, you know, wrapped up in a barbed wire because it was a top security place. And I graduated high school over there. And so then I moved to Moscow and to graduate at Moscow University. And then I defended PhD pretty soon. And then I was sent to the USA. So I became a visiting lecturer in biochemistry and molecular biology at Harvard Medical School for a year in the middle of the 70s. Then I came back to Russia, and surprise, surprise, I was considered not loyal because of my stay for a year in the United States. And it's a very simple paradigm that time, you know, I would say paranoia rather than paradigm back in the Soviet Union, because they thought that since this guy spent a year in the States, of course he was recruited by the CIA.
Yeah.
No question about it. And in fact, it was pretty logical for them, because I'm sure when an American fellow was in Russia that time, he was, of course, you know, a KGB or would be dancing around. And so they kind of linear, you know, comparison. They thought the same thing with me. And of course, I was recruited. Of course, they offered me money. Of course, I accepted. So from now on, I became a spy in the Soviet Union. However, times was changed. I was not imprisoned. Just for 9 years, I could not leave the country. And I was, I pretty soon, I defended my second degree called Doctor of Science. And when I was 31, I became full professor, which was, I have to say, without kind of false modesty, it was pretty rare situation. And so just picture this. I was a young scientist, pretty, you know, known, with lots of invitations from abroad. Everything paid, everything fine, set, but I couldn't leave because I was kind of, you know, quasi-spy.
Yeah.
They have when you prove that I was a spy, but it was a general suspicion. And so when only Gorbachev came to his office, things kind of trickled down. And after a while, they allowed me to travel a little bit. And then I went to the States for a couple of weeks, and then for a month, and then for 3 months. But still back in Russia, it was a tough life because, well, to say it directly, I was harassed pretty much. Because of, again, suspicion, I at least to put it mildly, so like he does much more for the United States than for the Soviet Union. That's a general description. So eventually, I was fed up, and I decided to go to the States, at least for a few years, and which I did. So in the very beginning of 1990, I went again to Harvard. I should say Harvard, you know, I don't know, normal Cambridge guys would say. And so, and I came almost like a patriarch, because since 1974, I was in the same lab. A lot of communications, a lot of travel when they did allow me. And so I gladly came back to my lab at Harvard Medical School, and I became professor of biochemistry. And I stayed for overall for about 12 years, being professor of biochemistry in the medical school. However, I was not tenured professor. That's why, you know, every year, any year I could end up out of the university. So I decided to move to, and I got an invitation from the industry. I became first a VP, visiting professor of a chemical engineering company, making new composite materials. And then I set up my own company, which soon became public, in biomedical research. So I started working in cancer research in a drug design area. And so, and that was fine for a number of years, but I somehow I was captured with the new science called DNA genealogy. And that would be probably the next step of our conversation.
Yeah, I just have to ask you real quick too. You were also the first person to use what we now call the internet in the USSR, correct?
Oh, well, do you know that? It is actually, it's a fascinating story. Sometimes, you know, I wake up and I couldn't believe myself. It's so surreal. So sometimes I think it's kind of, it's all just a dream, a night dream. And if you want to know, I can tell you because it's an interesting story indeed. When Der Spiegel learned about it, they sent a team of reporters to my lab in Boston for the interview. But actually, you know, Spiegel. There were two the most important questions, you know, to them, whether on the KGB knew about it, and second, how much do I earn in the United States?
Yeah.
So that's just, everything was around it. Yes, it is a really unbelievable story, because I worked in the United States, and I knew many people in the field of biotechnology, where generally speaking, I worked in. And so, and one day, the United Nations, well, actually it was in 1982, the United Nations sent an invitation to the Russian government inviting them for, as they put it, the first global computer conference. There is no word of internet at that time. Internet was coined only in 1990. Mm-hmm. In 82, we call it computer conferences. So I was called by the government, by a pretty high position government person. And he asked me, do I know anything about computer conferences? And I frankly say, no. So he says, so how come that there is a letter from the United Nations and they suggested, so the Soviet Union would take a part in the first global computer conference where only five countries will take part. It was Sweden, the United States, Germany, England, and the Soviet Union, if the government agrees. And they offered, or they suggested, he said, so you will be moderator of that first conference. So he said, how come? You have no idea what computer conferences are, and they suggested you to be a moderator. So I asked him, what subject is for that computer conference? He said, biotechnology. I said, well, now I can explain it, because I'm a consultant to the United Nations on biotechnology. I actually published two books with UNIDO, which is United Nations Industrial Development Organization. And so they know me, and that's why they decided to, you know, to mention my name. He said, okay, if so, he said, you go ahead and figure out what computer conference mean. So he said, if we have technical means, we'll think about it. Do we need it or not? If we don't have technical means, we'll say what we have no interest. It's very, very Soviet. You know, if we cannot do it, well, we have no interest in it. And so, and I went out, and eventually I found a place. I was working through directories in the Academy of Science at that time. There was not a word computer in the directory. But eventually I traced it, and it turned out a top secret place, right in the middle of Moscow, right close to the Kremlin wall. And that institute was freshly established, and they had a cable from Russia, from Moscow, to computer databases in Europe. So it's only my guess why they need so. I think they just they scavenge databases in Europe, you know, because nobody actually participated in any communications international at that time. And so I came back and reported. Actually, I wrote a letter and reported that they found the place. And then I met with the director of that institute, which called VNIPAS in Russian, mm-hmm. which is All Union Institute for Applied Automatic Systems, something like that. No computer also in the title. So I went to the director and explained that I was sent by the government to figure out whether or not we have technical means to work with the world. And he said, are you crazy? He said, frankly, what are you talking about? You know that you can't even make a phone call from the Soviet Union abroad without being, you know, listened. Mm-hmm. You cannot send a letter from the Soviet Union abroad without the letter would be opened and copied. And he said, you're talking about computer communications? He said, it's just impossible. Well, he said, we do have means. But nobody ever did anything like that, to be in a person who would participate, who would work, who will go outside, you know, electronically, and be a member of that, whatever, communication system. Well, I said, you know what, it's my least concern. Is it impossible or not? All I need to know is just to report whether or not we have technical means. And you know what, by that time, I already got a copy of that letter from the United Nations, and there was a login address and a password, just in case, if I get a permission. So I said, look, what, yeah, we do have that. How about to try? And he's a professional, of course, was very curious. In fact, he was working in the space too, about a couple of years before me. So we quickly found a common language. And so I said, look, you have a computer right here, so let's try. So he called his head of a department. The guy sat, put in login address, and said, okay, now your turn, you know, punch in your password. And he just turned his head on the side, just not to watch it. It was even very funny. And so I punched in the password, and boom, voila. It was Stockholm University, welcomes you. You know, I felt, as I, in many interviews about it, I said, you know, I felt like an astronaut, or cosmonaut, you said in Russian. It's like, I feel like I'm a chair of the astronaut, because I launched outside, and I went to the open universe without any permission, without any visa, without anything. So it was absolutely unbelievable. And so I reported it's possible. I got a pass. And I started to go into practice, and the director encouraged me to practice. And I feel I was kind of a guinea pig, because they followed how stable is the connection. Because it was very unstable at that time. Every probably 2 or 3 minutes, I would be thrown off the system. The system was very slow. In order to get a screen filled with letters, it would took about 2 to 3 minutes. Of course, no graphics whatsoever. And so, but eventually I got used to it. Then it was a permission. So the Soviet Union, the government directed me to compose a team to take a part of that worldwide computer conference. By that time, it was about 10 countries in it. So it happened in December of 1983. And so I collected people whom I knew in the field of biotechnology. By the way, most of them, a few years later, became members of the National Academy of Science. So I picked right people. And one of them, the fellow from Georgia, from Tbilisi, now he's the president of the Academy, of the National Academy.
So how did this network work? Did you have a modem, or how did you communicate?
Yes, I have a modem, and those who know what does it mean, it was 360 baud. 360 baud is a unit for speed of communication. Actually, speed with which a phone signal is transformed into a computer system. Vice versa. Computer signal is transformed to a phone system. And so, and right now, with the dial-up systems, which probably nobody uses, it's about 50,000 baud. Now, cables are millions of baud. I had 360, which was every letter will take probably like a second or 2, 3, sometimes 5 seconds to go to the next letter. It goes like boom, 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 and then it stops, again, boom, boom, stops, and then that goes on and on. So it will take about 2 to 3 minutes for a screen to fill. You know, it's very slow. However, still, euphoria was unbelievable. Because we got a system to immediate connection to with our foreign colleagues, and it was a mailbox. Either a connection was direct without any mailbox, but if our recipient or my colleague was not present that time, the message will go to mailbox pretty much as it goes now. And so, of course, it's no graphic. It was December of 83, Christmas time. So we sent each other, you know, pictures of Christmas trees and glasses of champagne made from, you know, crosses and zeros. That's what how normally we did in the 80s. Crosses and zeros. So it was a Christmas tree and everything. So it was fun. In December, it was over. However, something happened on the Soviet system, so I was not kicked out from that institute. They just forgot about me.
Mm.
And I decided to continue, and the director will continue to issue a pass every now and then for me to continue to work. And I started to come like to my workplace, but about 2 to 3 times a week for several hours, because I was the head of a lab at the Academy of Sciences. Everything was set up. I had a free schedule. So I spent about half a day every 2 or 3 days in that place. And it went for 7 years.
Wow.
So for 7 years, I was the only one, not only the Soviet Union, but the whole set of socialist countries, including China and Eastern Europe. So as one magazine calculated, I was one of about 2.5 billion people, only one, working in international computer system. Yeah, so it was fun, actually. Maybe I remember Rusty Schwekert, one of the first American astronauts. He was my pen pal. That time he wanted badly to establish a bridge, in a computer bridge, with the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And I wrote a number of letters because I saw how wonderful, how great is the system. But I thought for science. I couldn't even think that it was for, Josh Moore and from the street. I thought it's a scientific system. So I sent letters starting from the president of the Academy of Sciences to all vice presidents and to a number of high-positioned scientists at the Academy. Never, during the 7 years, never anybody answered me.
Hmm.
And first I was kind of angry because, like, what's going on? I'm totally ignored with such a wonderful system. And then I realized those guys just were careful because totalitarian system and the internet, they don't match. They don't go together. On the reason I explained it before, because it would be absolutely impossible for those people to do anything. So the computer conference in the Soviet Union in the 80s would become feasible or legal, because even Xerox machines were sealed. Every Russian knows, or Soviet, I should know at that time. So in order to make a Xerox copy, you go to a special classified department.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
So it would be like every institute, like our Institute of Biochemistry, it had a special room, which they call a first department, or department number one, because it was normally KGB controlled. And every institute had such a department where all classified information went through, if there is any. In our institute, there was none. It was the Academic Institute of Biochemistry. But still, we had a department number one, and all our papers got a stamp of permission to get published. And so a KGB guy would run the system. So now, and he controlled a Xerox machine. So in order to go and to make a copy, even one page, even a private letter, if you wish, you file for permission, you file a special application on paper, you sign it. The copy of material you made in Xerox, it would be filed along with my application. So can you imagine if in the system you have internet, international communications? It would be absolutely not possible.
Yeah.
So anyway, in 1984, so about 2 years after I started, I couldn't wait. It was not only silly, it was a crime to keep them just only for me, for myself. Though I was just flourishing with my communications. I keep sending papers abroad for publishing. I kept editing books jointly, which absolutely was illegal back in the Soviet Union. If they would learn about this, I would probably not be talking to you right now.
Oh, yeah.
And in 84, I just decided to do something about it. And so I went to the general secretary of the Russian Academy of Sciences, Soviet Academy of Sciences, who knew me, I knew him, and apparently he treated me nicely. All years he knew me. And I told him, he said, with permission, I said, of course, of the government, I'm working for now 2 years in that computer communication system. And I told him, well, he got excited. He said, look, that's a great material to publish. And he was editor-in-chief of the propaganda magazine that time called Science in the USSR. In that, it was pretty good quality journal. now published in Finland, as I remember, on a nice paper, sent back to the Soviet Union, and it was sent around the world. And with all best achievements, no lie, I mean, really good scientific materials in that journal. However, it was like, of course, propaganda machine. So he said, how about you write a paper for our, you know, journal that's Science in the USSR? Because he said, that would be a great illustration how advanced is the Soviet Union. And we participate in computer conferences as well as the most advanced countries in the world. You see, he already turned it in kind of in a propaganda way. Of course, I was just alone, but I didn't tell him. Probably he knew, or maybe he sensed. So I wrote a paper to that journal, and the paper was banned. So it was not allowed to publish.
Well, Anatoly, I wanted to switch gears a little bit. You brought up propaganda science, and it was in 2012 when I first came across your research re-examining the Out of Africa theory, and I was really excited about that because no one touches this dogma in America because it wouldn't be politically correct. So how did you first get interested in examining the Out of Africa story?
I will tell you, not in America. It's the same, essentially same in Russia right now, because it's kind of very orthodox theory. Russians, in much less extent, believe in it. However, the Academy of Science has accepted the dogma. You're absolutely right. You have to be really independent to do studies like that. Now, how I came to it. First, I thought that indeed it is proven that a modern people, I mean anatomically modern people, came out of Africa about 70,000 years ago. Well, how it was explained in all main academic journals. And then when I just believed, I didn't look into the matter seriously. I just thought, well, they're professionals. Of course, they know what they're talking about. But then at some point, I decided to look on which evidence it is based. And I took the first journal's papers from which the first was published essentially in 1987, and I was terrified. There was no base whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It was all conjectures, stretches, guesses, nothing else. In fact, the abstract of the very first paper in 1987 says it was belonged probably to a woman who lived probably in Africa, probably 200,000 years ago.
Mitochondrial Eve, right?
Yeah, it was decided mitochondrial at that time. So everything was probably or supposedly. Then the paper was denounced, in fact, 4 years after, and co-authors published a second paper. The first may not already not among the authors of the second paper. However, it was too late because the media, as you can imagine, they just went nuts the first published. Great, where our ancestors are from Africa. And it sounds so nice. Well, indeed, because we kind of fair color people, indeed we feel guilt before a black color people because of many years of exploitation, slavery, and something. I have the same feeling deep inside of me. In fact, I'll tell you that I felt the same thing with respect to the Jews, because I felt that in the Soviet Union, it was such a harm, brought to the Jews. So I also feel the same guilt. When I explained this to Jewish people, they, come on, and you're
except for the Jewish Bolsheviks, because they were mostly Jews.
That's true, too. You know, that's a very complicated matter.
Yeah.
So anyway, the point was that the story looked really great, particularly for liberals, which love that kind of stories. They love to apologize, which, of course, sometimes we need to apologize, no question about it. However, it should be based on a real reason, not on a made-up reason and a full-up apology. So I decided to go into it. And my profession allowed me to do it because I graduated a chair of chemical kinetics in Moscow University. And the head of our chair was a Nobel Prize winner, Semyonov, who actually the only one chemist in the Soviet Union and Russia who won the Nobel Prize. So I was a student. I got pretty good school. I wrote many textbooks on kinetics of chemicals, chemical and biological reactions. Kinetics is a science on reactions at velocities, how fast or slow reactions are and why. So it was easy for me to move that science to the DNA, to mutations in the DNA, and to see where mutations were, you know, arose, what time, where probably. And so I looked closely into the matter on Africans. And it turned out there is not a single proof of Africans, of that our ancestors came from Africa.
Yeah.
Not a single one. And I described it in a few papers, and they followed very closely, and sometimes really ridiculous how they explain it. I mean, we assign some index to different tribes. So index A was ascribed to the Africans. So now when we find something with an index A, they say, okay, look, there's the Africans because they're from Africa. Say, how about if we ascribe a W to the same mutation? We still will be from Africa. So there is a circling argument. Everything which is A in a tribe, it is African. However, we have to look into the matter more deeply. So it turned out that our evolution tree comes from, and it would be not scientific term to say from monkeys, but from gorilla, from orangutan, from chimpanzee, from macaque, where plenty of mutations, irreversible mutations in our bodies, in our DNA, which we acquired from those monkeys, so to speak, millions and millions of years ago. And then the evolution tree went from, and we have in our DNA, there are more than 90% of the same mutations in the DNA as in a chimpanzee. So when we take a chimpanzee from a zoo and run a DNA test, it's more than 90% mutations as in us. So they're pretty stable. However, we don't have mutations from our African friends. From a black Africans, we don't have mutations. You know, from chimpanzee 5 million years ago, we have plenty. From the Africans, and the Homo sapiens was kind of, you know, as we assume was, you know, arose about 200,000 years ago, much less time, we don't have. And so I went again more and more deep into the matter, and I started to analyze publications, and now most of them which mention Africa, kind of the first phrase is, as it is well established, or is it well known, our ancestors came out from Africa. It's already dogma.
Yeah, it is.
It's already taken as it's postulated as a fact. No, it's not. And you know, and interesting that now we have more and more papers on studying genome, which is a very advanced field. Well, when we look in the genome, it contains millions and millions of mutations, irreversible. They form a pattern. So scientists compare genome in one part of the world with genome in other part of the world and see how much similar or different those mutations are. So now when they study Africa, they put as a base that anatomically modern people came out of Africa. And they bent all the data, I know, consciously or unconsciously, maybe to get a good grant, maybe something, or people are weak. They can easily be bought, many of them, with the grant money.
Yeah.
If you apply for a grant that our ancestor didn't come from Africa, you will not get any grant.
That's right.
But if you file a grant that you're going to prove it even better, you get a little some money. So that's why it's a crime indeed in science when science brain is now bought, it's purchased for grants when it's politically sound. It should not be done like this. However, that's what happens. Now, imagine last week a paper came out very fresh. When authors of the paper studying genome, and they want to go deeper into the matter. They want not only to prove that people came from Africa, it's given for them. That was, again, the first phrase of the paper. It is well known. They wanted to look into which directions they came from Africa. And they considered two ways, either through Ethiopia, the southern way, or through Egypt, the northern way. Now imagine how they showed it. They took genome of Egyptians, African they considered, and they took genomes of people outside of Africa, and showed that people in Egypt show similarity with people outside of Africa. And to them, it's a proof that the people came from Africa by northern way.
Yeah, and they think there was a lot of interbreeding going on, and I'd say, yeah, some, not all.
Of course, in Egypt, there is more than 80% of people, actually 96%, I was going to say, 96% of their mutations are exactly the same as outside of Africa, in Asia, in Europe, in everywhere. So it could be the same way that it could be. It's known that last of them came to Egypt when it was Islamization of Egypt in about, 9th century A.D. Plenty of Arabs came to Africa and brought them their mutations with them. So and they found that in Ethiopia, there are much less mutations with an outside world, and the southern way wouldn't work. Of course, if they look at Yemen, which is just around the strait, they have a completely different genetics than in Ethiopia. So you can't even consider, you don't even need an even genome to see that. So in such a primitive approach, they claim that they showed a northern way, they showed direction. And mass media already greeted, look, it's a great advancement in science. Now we already know which way they came out of Africa. It's really, I can't even find a proper word to describe it.
So are you more inclined towards the multi-regional model of human evolution? I know the Chinese reject the out-of-Africa theory, and they kind of support a multi-regional idea that humans came from various places.
You know, what they rejected out of Africa only shows that Chinese are smart people. Now, regarding multi-regional, it's many confusions about that multi-regional, because there is one evolution tree, which comes from time immemorial, millions of years ago, and then it branches. And when we have branches from that evolution tree in different parts of the world, is it multi-regional? No, they came from the same source. They came from the same evolution tree. So in order to semi, it's like you look at the tree and see that branches, they take a wide space around. Is it multi-regional? Yeah. Judging from their current locations, they sit in different locations. However, they all came out from the same trunk, right? So you cannot call them multi-regional. So in order to even to describe multi-regional, you have to define what do you mean. Means that the evolution tree was different from those multi-regional. It didn't come from the same, from chimpanzee, or they come from chimpanzee. They went through a Neanderthal split off, and then only in Homo sapiens, wherever it appeared, about 200,000 years ago, and then people went around. You cannot call it multi-regional. So you have to explain. By multi-regional, you mean just a place where those remains were found, or you talk about deep history. And that's why Chinese, I believe, by multi-regional, they mean that pretty old bones found like in China and dated 400,000 years ago, or 300,000 ago, or 500,000 years ago. But it does not mean they don't belong to the same evolution tree. But region, yes, indeed, it's a multi. So I believe that two things are mixed together. You have to be more clear. I'm not talking to you personal, of course, but people have to be more clear. What do they mean? Right now, of course, it's multi, but with the same root. My brother lives now in Russia, lives in the U.S. Is it multi-original? No, we have the same father.
So how do you think modern humans came to evolve the way they did? Because then we also have to classify there are different races of people, and we've all evolved differently. So how do you think this has come to be?
You know, races went out of fashion in science.
Oh, I know. Yes, it's not politically correct to talk about race anymore, right?
And I stick to science. When I talk about natural science, there is no political correctness over there. It should not be.
That's right.
And the same way I'm against that swastika should be exposed around during the demonstrations. However, swastika belongs to scientific publications.
Well, it's also the Kolev Rot, right? It's it's an old Slavic symbol.
That's true, too. So when we talk about ancient, archaeological cultures and we find swastika, they, of course, they go to papers. It's not politically incorrect to show that those people used swastika 5,000 years ago. So it's not political correctness. So anyway, the point is that races, of course, in the old time, we had, as I see it, we have two principal races. We had a Black Africa. However, people who are not out of Africa, but they live probably forever since millions of years ago outside of Africa. By the way, Neanderthal was not a black skin person. Neanderthal was a fair skin and reddish hair, among other things. He was not African. However, he lived only like 300,000 to 400,000 years ago. So he didn't come out of Africa. And so not necessarily that everything is attached to Africa. And it's a great continent, but not for everything. So now the thing is that the common ancestor of all non-Africans in our world arose only about 65,000 years ago. Because when we study the DNA in all people on our planet, except the Africans, all of them, they coalesce to the common ancestor for all of them who lived about 65,000 years ago. So since it was the only person which technically the father of all the non-African population, it would have could be only of one race, right? He was the only one who survived. So that particular person who survived, of course, he was not alone. A lot of people around him, they died out, and only his offspring survived. That's why he was a common ancestor. That's why all the DNA mutations go to him. We don't know his name, but evidently 65,000 years ago. But he was the only person who survived in our generations. He had only one race. And then out of that one race came, during the 65,000 years, came, Chinese, American Indians, that Finns and Swedes and British and Russians and the Mexicans. And so all people of different skin colors and hair colors and everything, in fact, they had as one ancestor that one person. So that's why races, they formed only during those 65,000 years ago, plus, of course, the black race in the Black Africa. So that's why, and then what changes the race, as you well know, women. In fact, I would be forgiven if I say they kind of men the same way. Women, they kind of move around between different men, and they sort of equalize their genetics. They take the DNA from a man, and now their offspring is equalized. Her DNA and the father DNA, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's already kind of became more equilibrium. And then the more time passed, the more open society, it's more and more equalized. And eventually, you can extrapolate probably in some time ahead of us, of course, a long time ahead of us, it will be more or less the same race, same equal race for all people. So that's why now, as you know, because a multi-racial marriages all kind of dilutes the races. And
yes,
very often you can't even tell. You know, for example, take American Indians. There is no definite race from many viewpoints. They're the same as us, the Europeans.
But what if we focus on, I know you've done quite a bit of research into Proto-Indo-Europeans and Aryans, and this is very controversial. So where do you think Indo-Europeans or Aryans come from? Because they're very fair-skinned and light and tall and beautiful. I mean, they're really different compared to everyone else.
You watch too many movies. When we get there, right, and tall and beautiful, it's only from the movies, nothing else.
Oh, I've lived in Sweden. There's a lot of good-looking people in the Nordic countries.
Well, speaking scientifically, Aryans is a scientific term. It has nothing to do with Nazi Germany.
Sure, I know that.
Only now can study the DNA, now we can see who were Aryans, who Aryans were. And it turned out that, of course, the closest Aryans you can get, they're upper caste in India. Because when the Aryans came to India, about around 3,500 years ago, they set up a caste system in India. And of course, naturally, they took an upper caste and claimed they are upper caste. And so when we took DNA samples from hundreds of those Indian caste and upper caste, up to 72% of the upper strata of the Indians, they carry a specific mutation, which is classified as R1A. Now, what does it mean, R1A? There are about 20 tribes in our planet, according to geneticists. And every tribe carries specific mutations. So any person can test for the DNA, immediately explain that which tribe does he belong. I'm talking about male, only man. Women is a similar system, but different. I mean, similar in kind, but different in practically. And so all those 20 tribes are labeled from A to T in Latin alphabet. Now, R is a pretty young, relatively, you know, close to the end, close to the T. And so R is a tribe, as I explained. Now, there are different levels in that R tribe. R1, R2, no more. Now, and then there are R1A and R1B. So East Europeans are mainly R1A. And West Europeans and Atlantic Europeans are mainly R1B. So see how similar we are. We're R1, and only third level, we're R1A or R1B. So Indians are R1A. There is no R1B in India. Practical none. So now when we start to trace where else the R1A turned out, 50% of Polish, R1A. 50% of Ukrainians, R1A. 50% of Belarus, R1A. 50% of the Russians, up to 67% in Russia, R1A. And now when we started to map the whole world, we saw the migration path of the Aryans, how they come to India and to those upper, you know, caste. And it turned out that R1A, that first mutation, appeared about 20,000 years ago in South Siberia. So believe it or not, but Europeans, West and East, are descendants of Siberian people.
Yeah, and there's a lot of ancient finds in Siberia as well.
Absolutely. More than that, a couple of years ago, even less than that, there was a publication, sensational, when researchers found and they discovered in South Siberia on Baikal Lake on the shore, well, actually not technically sure, about 40 kilometers, it's about 25 miles from Baikal Lake, they found the bones, which dated 24,000 years ago, and they were characterization R. So are indeed the oldest times when we know, 24, 24,000 years ago. It's a South Siberia. So both R1A and R1B, again, appeared in South Siberia and migrated to Europe. It's a very long way, thousands of miles, very long time, thousands of years for that migration. But they came to Europe by different ways. So now the R1A came from the Altai, apparently, area. They came through Tibet, through probably northern India. They came to Iranian plateau. They came from through nowadays Turkey, which is called Anatolia. They came to the Balkans, and they lived in Europe. And about 5,000 years ago, something happens. You know, I guess I know what happens, but maybe next time. And they moved to the Russian plain to the east, and continue. And they split. Some of those Aryans came to the south over Caucasian mountains to Mesopotamia, and historians know so-called the Mitanni Aryans about 4,000 years ago in Syria nowadays. Another branch came to Iran, to Iranian plateau again that time, and they became so-called Avesta Aryans. And another branch came to Ural Mountains and down south to India, and they became Indo-Aryans. So everything now is known and dated. We know virtually every part, every chain in that way of the Aryans. They went to India, and they brought in the European language. Now, and they brought in the European language from Europe across the Russian plain and across the Ural Mountains down to India. And that's why, and then other people who lived on the Russian plain, and also those R1B who came to Europe by, again, a very roundabout way. And they eventually acquired that Indo-European language, and now all Europe, except Hungary, Finland, and Estonia, they speak Indo-European language. So now we know pretty well how it appeared, how it was moving, and of course people care languages. You know, when they walk, they talk to each other.
Sure, right? Of course.
You said keep going in silence. And so that's why, but you know what the problem is? There are so many established dogmas in linguistics and history and archaeology. And what's happened in archaeology, it's a great science. However, they're very restricted with their interpretations. So imagine they found some spear in one part of the world, a similar spear in the other part of the world. So clearly they're similar. So how come? Either people move over there, it was migration, or they traded, or maybe it was stolen, maybe it was a trophy, they don't know. And that's why they conjectured something. They just came up with an explanation. Explanation, not necessarily correct one. However, when the people with a good authority expressed it, it goes to the textbooks and became a dogma.
Well, it's just like in America, their Ice Age Europeans were the oldest here. We have remains of that, but no one talks about who the true Native Americans are, who were actually Caucasians.
Of course, it is very painful when you try to explain through scientific papers to linguists, to historians, to many other specialties, that the situation is different. That's what the DNA shows. They react very painfully because their career is based on those not necessarily correct interpretations. Their grants they were on right now are not necessarily correct anymore. So do you think they're going to say, no, take back that money. We don't need it because we changed our view. Never. They will continue to fight to death for that.
Yes.
You know, things they actually based their scientific career on. Talk about the homeland of Indo-European languages. There are about 25 theories counted of the homeland of Indo-European languages, starting from India and then Anatolia and then the Balkans and the steppes close to Black Sea, and just name it. now, and they look for homeland. It's very respected area to look for homeland in linguistics. But when they work with the DNA, clearly there was no any homeland. Languages don't appear in one isolated place. They don't even branch from one isolated place. They always conversion and diversion, and they go, they fluctuating, they move around, and there is no homeland. It's clear because all that what I mentioned now, I mentioned 5 hours, 25, it was just a transition points. The Aryans went through India, they went through Anatolia, they went through the Balkans, they went through that Pontic steppes in the south Ukraine and Russia, and none of them were homeland.
Yeah, it's true. And they've left remnants behind of their cultures. We find similarities all across the globe.
Of course.
I guess now what's, because you're talking about kind of like we don't really have an original home, but there have been groups of people who have been in a certain area for thousands of years. I think that's how we've also evolved differently because we've been isolated in that particular area of the globe. Would you agree?
Well, since you challenge me, let me respond in such a way. Just take those groups, R1A and R1B, which indeed, Eastern Europe and Western Europe, they certainly took part in a modern civilization. Because people in Greece, people in ancient Rome, they belong to the same tribes. So essentially, all we know, well, we assume their civilization is a big puzzle. Because we don't know yet Sumerians, ancient Sumerians, to where they belong. And from my calculations and consideration, they belong to R1B, which is now Western Europe. Because and there are a few landmarks which show that how those R1B people, I call them Arbians, because R1B. It's, instead of to say every time R1B, they're Arbians. So an R1A is Aryans, if you talk about ancient times. So those Arabians, they came, as I said, across the, Asia, and then they turned through Caucasus, went to Mesopotamia, and then they went to, they apparently established Sumer state, and then they went across Egypt in northern Africa to the nowadays Spain and Portugal. Now, there's a few hints that they went that way because there is still unconfirmed finding that Pharaoh Tutankhamun, he was R1B. So actually, it connects many things how the Arabians moved. But anyway, talk about R1B and R1A. Now, talk about civilization. R1A, as I said, came from South Siberia. They came through that thousand way, they came to the Balkans and they populated Europe. It's about 8 to 7 thousand years ago. 5,000 years ago, R1B came, being nomads in Asia. And then, of course, if they really established Sumer state, there are no nomads anymore. When they went through Egypt, they probably haven't been nomads anymore. And so they're already pretty sophisticated in with metals and metallurgy. And they came through that nowadays Spain and Portugal came to Europe and populated. And you know what? I feel not very comfortable to even to say it. But since they came to Europe, all the Europe disappeared. We can't see any of those tribes in Europe anymore. We see them in excavated. In the bones, but after 5,000 years ago and 4,500 years ago when those Arabians came, they all disappeared. However, we can see only remnants of those disappeared people. Some of them ran to the British Isles, and still now we see those descendants from those old-timers. Now, some of them ran to Danube River. Some of them ran to Asia Minor. And then the Caucasus, but nothing left in Europe. And that's why now up to 60% on the whole Europe, Central and Western, we see those R1B descents. Everybody else came to Europe much later. So now let's come back to civilization. What was destruction and in fact, genocide apparently in Europe, was it a civilization? Well, I doubt it. But after it, R1B, they created a great civilization. I mean, talking about nowadays people, in fact, Romans were probably mainly R1B, and Greeks are a good part R1A and R1B. So now Scandinavians, they have their own tribes, different tribes. However, it's a great civilization. So it's very difficult to tie that civilization to any particular population. It was probably in synergism. They work together, and we can dissect as much as we can and see who contributed what. However, I really don't like that who contributed what became a competition, who made the greatest contribution to a modern civilization. For example, Einstein belonged to the tribe E, which is not, you know, really noticeable on the horizon of that competition between R1A, R1B. Now, Napoleon Bonaparte was E, but Hitler was E too. You see, the same tribe, talk about Einstein, Napoleon, and Hitler. So difficult to tell what contribution of which tribe was into modern civilization.
But you can kind of trace some tribes because, like I said, they leave behind some remnants, and then you can say, oh, wait, that's the same people. Yeah.
Yes, you know, that's what we're doing right now. We're mapping the world, and successfully, it's really hard to believe that after only a few years, such a great progress was made in that area. It was mapping is done at a good extent. Now, but still mapping is done mainly based on people who live where now, because it's easy to measure. However, who live there now, not necessarily their ancestors live for the same place. However, excavated DNA came out. Now we can dig the old, you know, graves, burials or whatever, battlefields. We take bones, fragment of bones. You need just 1 gram, couple of grams of the bone. And you extract the DNA from the bone. And you multiply it. In fact, when I said 1 to 2 grams, not necessarily, because the favorite object is a tooth for those DNA researchers. You take a micro drill, you drill through the tooth, get a few milligrams of that pulp, dry pulp, and it still has a viable DNA in it. And you take it out, you multiply by special means, and you come up with who that person who lived there a long, long time ago. You can find his descendants right now, personally, direct descendants. And you can see who are those people who lived there a long time ago.
Just a couple more questions for you, since you know so much. I wanted to know from a biological standpoint, if modern humans today were to basically, we're race mixing a lot, we're outbreeding certain traits until there's going to be possibly no visible race that exists anymore, would we be destroying human biodiversity to a point where it could be catastrophic, or could we become something else entirely?
This is exaggerated a lot, this saying. In fact, there are population geneticists which calculate that in about, 30, 40, 50 years, you know, everything would be equal, would come to the equilibrium, and it will be all mixed up. Not at all. It would have happened if we would be absolutely promiscuous. You know, if we don't care whom we make an offspring with. But it doesn't happen that way. American Indians, they marry mainly American Indian women and vice versa. Now, the Russians mainly marry Russian women. If you go to villages, particularly remote, you would see many Mongolians or Africans or whoever, actually none. We are very selective with our whom we choose being our partner. I'm talking about marriage.
Yeah.
We pick our own people. That's in our genes, it's in our brain, and that's why it continues that way. There are very little mixing and interbreeding.
Because you see, in America, they push it so much nowadays. That's a modern thing, though.
Yeah, I know, but American is always advanced in everything, and good and bad. and so, indeed, it is kind of politically correct. Because before it was, as you know, of course, there was a lot of harassment when for that interracial marriage. Yeah. But still, even when you take statistically, you take, well, 200 plus million people in America and count how many of them they are interracial marriage, it would be probably a fraction of 1%, even less. So we talk about cities, big cities. We talk about Los Angeles, I talk about New York City, Washington, D.C., Boston, but it's not in Middle West, in the Midwest.
Yeah.
It's not in many other places. People there are much more conservative in that regard. I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's just a fact. We choose our own people. That's what, so far, it's a main denominator in our behavior. Of course, there are more adventurous people. There are more kind of, you know, breakheads. There are more genuine love, of course. It happens. But again, it's kind of a little.
Well, I wanted to ask you, too, from a genetic standpoint, since we do choose our own people, and now it seems, you know, the governments are pushing, you know, mass immigration into Europe and into America, and it's this kind of multiracial, multicultural. Has this ever existed before?
I doubt it. You know what? When we look with excavated DNA, normally we see only clusters. We don't see foreigners. For example, there is, in fact, it was exciting find discovery in the northwest of Chinese. They were found many people who, you know, mummies of those people, who died about 4,000 years ago. All of them were R1A. Not a single one, anything else.
Oh, the Tarim Basin mummies? Maybe?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the Tarim Basin mummies. Only R1A. In fact, those who are in Eastern Europe, mainly, at least now. Now, when we talk about a culture like Andronova culture, recently with an excavation found 10 bones. Oh, whatever, skeletons. And 9 of them are 1A, 1 was C, mongoloid. But we don't know that C could have been a good member, however, it could be a slave, it could be a servant, it could be whoever, right? We don't know. But still, 90% were just the same, R1A. Talk about the upper caste, how Indians resist. Again, I'm not going to say it's good or bad. They wanted to preserve their, whatever, blood. Very politically incorrect. However, they managed to keep up to 72% after 3,500 years, the same people. Though I tend to believe that in the old times, call them good old times or bad old times, people were clusterized. They didn't want to have foreign. I can give my own actual example. I know my ancestor for 14 generations down. My great-great-great, whatever, he was born in 1575. And he, for his, all of them, all 14 generations were military people. They were cavalry, all those 14 generations. So, and my first great-great who was born in 1575 was in the beginning of 17th century. He was granted the land from the Tsar. And the land is, well, it's to measure it by football fields, 180 football fields. Pretty good land. And so, and he set up a village on that land. And for 350 years, there is the same, my last name, Klyosov, lives in that village, and the name of that village is Klyosov. It's in the Kursk area, Kursk region in Russia. Now, and I know from history, because I know archives pretty well, to never let anybody else, males, into that village.
Yeah.
They took, gladly, of course, women, they marry women, which they, you know, look for. Women came, will come to them, they look around. But there was a very simple logic. you know, this land they got for military service, right?
Mm-hmm.
So why some guy will come over and sit on that land?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's a kind of, he doesn't belong here. And so they resisted very much so. When I came to that village a couple of years ago, I took some DNA samples. All of them are exactly my DNA.
Oh.
So, after 350 years.
That's great.
So see, that's a little, that's a kind of little model how people lived an old time, many years ago. Indeed, there is a tribe, there is a clan, and all of them, of course, are relatives, because that's what our clan formed. Why they will take anybody from a side? It could have been a spy, or it doesn't probably share the same beliefs, same customs, same traditions. Apparently, there were some exceptions. Maybe a good warrior, right?
Yeah.
However, I believe generally, people live pretty much, you know, in isolation from other clans or tribes. Now, of course, it's shattered. Now it's globalization. You know, generally, some think, some in me, I like the globalization. I like the internet. I like watching TV movies and everything, which I do very, you know, seldom. No time for that. However, it's a good thing. What is a not very good thing, which I don't really like, is that not only good things spread around. There are not very good things spread around. We have terror. We have terrorists. We have a lot of, you know, those peaceful invasions to other countries from aside. Of course, those poor people, they want to be safe. They want to have a better future. However, there is the erosion, huge erosion, of habits and traditions.
That's right.
Lifestyle in many, many countries. My daughter and her family lives in France, so I'm often in France. And I see, of course, I would love those people, the migrants. They have a better future. However, they have a different lifestyle.
Yeah.
They have different traditions. For them, it's very difficult to adjust, to adapt to a new system. And they talk about a Muslim population in the United States. I love they have better future. But what we see right now... Many of them, they go back to Middle East. They fight against us. Let's be direct. So they couldn't adjust. They couldn't adapt. So that's why we have a mix of good and not good things. So, of course, it leads to an erosion of society. Something probably improves it. Some people probably call to kind of a degradation.
And now, unfortunately, white people aren't having as many babies. So that's another... problem. Our population could be replaced.
Yeah, you see, I personally don't like the term white people. Probably.
Yeah, I know. what should I say then?
I don't know. Politically correctness in my, so I'm spoiled now. I can't.
Well, now it's politically correct to hate white people, right? They exist. They don't exist, but then they exist when you want to hate them.
Of course, I know what you mean. There's no question about it. Yes, of course, and adapting and things. On the one hand, there's a theory that adapting to genetics doesn't play any role. It's education. You know, when you adopt an infant, and it doesn't matter what in his or her genes, education, environment, they will come up as a good citizen, and probably it's true in very many cases. However, I've studied alcohol abuse, actually at Howard University. For a number of years, I've studied biochemistry of alcohol abuse. And I know statistics with alcoholics. And I know that, again, in terms of political correctness, it is a disease, alcoholism, right?
Yeah.
It is a disease. People don't have that, they're not guilty. They become alcoholics. It's just a disease. Forget about environment. At the same time, there were a number of genetic studies, or not only genetics, maybe you couldn't call it biochemical, maybe call it even social studies, when twins are sons of an alcoholic person, they were separated at birth. And there is, I don't remember the number, like a 70 or maybe 80% likelihood they also become alcoholics. In spite of the environment.
Yeah.
In spite of great care. In spite of everything. There is a good chance they are more prone to substance abuse. And that's why, of course, when parents, or not parents, but not biological parents, they adopt people, of course, they have to face that the crude reality, anything can happen. Of course, it's a heroic act, to take the burden and to try to do their best. However, that's a great risk.
Yeah, genes are a powerful thing. Well, I had last question for you before I let you go. Where do you think human evolution is heading next? Because we don't just stop evolving, right?
Well, I think it's heading to a great future.
We're not de-evolving. It seems like people are becoming dumber.
Seriously, since I may be an optimist, I see a development of progress for thousands of years, and goes exponentially progressive. Unfortunately, progress is tremendous in weaponry. Unfortunately, whatever was the progress was turned to a killing machine. Whatever happened, people invented wheel. Now we see tanks and artillery things. And whatever good people invent, there's always bad goes in concert. That's what worries me. I know that almost everybody else. Unfortunately, terrorism it goes wider and wider because of some political clear mistakes were made.
Yeah,
clearly. Because we Americans, and now I say we Americans, of course I'm an American citizen, we naively think that we can bring democracy and people will greet it. They will joyful.
We bring it in with bombs too.
That's true too. But the bombs just to give them a lesson, right? The democracy is good.
Yeah.
Bomb them and they will love it. So that's unfortunately, that's a problem. So it means that your question has a dual answer. Either it would be great for future indeed, which I hope very much so, or it would be a pretty bad situation, which, I would say, I hate to tell it, but it's almost 50-50 as I see it.
Yeah.
Being again Russian, I see with pain what's going on between Ukraine, but Ukraine.
Aren't they the same people?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, I answered the question many times because genetically, from your point of the DNA, same thing. In Ukraine, RNA, and Russian RNA, was the same thing, all other, just the same thing. And I remember when I gave a lecture, sometimes from time to time in Moscow, I give my book presentations, and I have a whole bunch of books on the DNA genealogy. And I mentioned that Ukrainians and Russians are the same people. And when the lecture was over, and people started to applaud in Moscow. When it was over, a multi-star general came to me. Three-star. He came to me and said, "Is it really true that Russians and Ukrainians are genetically the same people?" I said, "Absolutely." He said, "It is very important. People should know about
exactly.
It."
Exactly. You would unify them.
Yeah, the same people. And I know my mother is Ukrainian, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Oh, technically Ukrainian. She left Ukraine when she was a small girl, a little girl. But I belong to them in a way. But what's going on now, I'm terrified. I'm really in pain when I watch news. But I watch news from Ukraine and from Russia. Because the U.S. almost don't mention it.
No.
There is no such a thing as that war. No, civil war in Ukraine. And that's your civil war. Because one part of Ukraine fights with another part of Ukraine. Now, and I hear, rivers of lie about it. And since I'm from time to time in Moscow, I see how people react to it. And indeed, again, rivers of lie about Russian involvement into that Ukrainian, because a lot of troops from Russia, supposedly, and Russian, lots of tanks and everything, and it's ridiculous, because everyone who serves in the army, they know what does it mean to bring a column of tanks from one place to another, because it will be miles and miles of supply, and everything like spare parts and all things, you can miss it. I mean, any satellite will trace it momentarily. And when I hear that there are 200,000 troops of Russia in Ukraine, there are thousands of tanks of Russia in Ukraine, it's just, I just almost laughing.
Yeah.
It just cannot be. And so, of course, they volunteers, no question about it. There are people who volunteer to go, but it's not directed by the Russian government.
Well, Anatole, I appreciate your time this afternoon. Can you please share your website details and any other publications you'd like us to know about?
With my website, which is HTTP, surprise, right?
Yeah, surprise.
Double slash, and then my first initial A, my last name KLYOSOV, A Klyosov, .home.comcast.net.
You also have a lot of books. Do you have anything available in English?
In English, I have only books in medicine.
Okay.
Yeah. Only medical books. And, of course, books on enzymes and everything related to biomedical research.
Yeah, because you have a lot of interesting research papers, but they're in Russian. So.
Well, there are some. In fact, my best downloaded papers are in English, because I happen to be an editor-in-chief of a journal named Advances in Anthropology. And this is an international journal published in the United States. It's in English. And by the way, four papers on Africa are in this journal. By the way, the first one was published in 2012. It has a record number of downloading and viewing. It's close to 90,000 views, and I don't know, like 40,000 or something, I don't remember really, downloading, which is really not usual for academic journals. And so those papers are in English, and there is a paper, separate one, about R-beans, so R1B, which came to Europe, and a separate paper on R1A. There's a paper on linguistics of Asian people, again, judging from those tribes and the roots of their migrations. There are paper on Asian pots. You know, pots, they typically mark archaeological culture.
Mm-hmm.
And picture on those pots are reproducible over centuries. People were very conservative at that time. And those pots came from Europe to China in Cambodia, believe it or not, same pots. And so that's interesting. You see swastika, by the way, among Indian tribes.
That's right. It's all over.
But excavated also. So they couldn't be from Nazi Germany.
And they were in the Ukraine as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. In Ukraine, because it was an old Aryan sign. You can even see there is an old map was published in 1890, which at that time swastika was kind of a neutral sign. It was no Nazi Germany yet for about half a century ahead. And there are a little swastikas were put on a map where it was found. And interesting to see how many swastikas have been around in 1890. And by the way, even now in Arabic countries, in those religious places, temples, you see swastika.
That's right.
Right along the wall, along the ceiling. In India, of course, swastika is absolutely a common thing. They all came from those ancient Aryans. When you read it, when you study it, you kind of get rid of all your prejudice Of course.
Well, I don't have any because I read a lot of World War II revisionist history, so I think the Germans have been demonized.
When I actually, on one of those book presentations, I told that I really appreciate when I see those Asian swastikas, because for me it's a label. For me it's like I can trace those migrations.
Yeah, I forgot to ask, how accurate are those DNA genealogy tests anyway? They seem a little fishy.
Oh, they're pretty accurate. I mean, it depends, of course, what do you want to get from it. If you measure those mutations, they're virtually 100% accurate. Because what you do, you run DNA sequencing, and everything is equipped, everything is computerized, and you run several times. So that's why when you got those mutations, they're there. Now comes interpretation. And interpretation could be flawed. That's a different story. So that's why when responsible scientists, when they interpret, they always look for another explanation. And they go for a cross-examination, like a good detective. Detective also, there are some good and not good. They're impulsive or they're not. They're meticulous. So same thing in science. It takes brain training to be really responsible for what you're doing.
Is that something that you offer? Do you have a lab that offers those kinds of tests?
I'm setting up a lab in Moscow to run two things. One, to have a mass testing. Now, and the second directional of that lab would be excavated DNA, Asian DNA. And there are absolutely limitless possibilities. There's so many bones. I mean, each museum, there are hundreds and hundreds of them, each museum has tons of those bones in back rooms. And we can get, I was in Georgia, and by the way, I'm a member of the National Academy of Sciences of Georgia. So when I was in Georgia and I gave my lecture, after which they elected me, regarding DNA genealogy of the Caucasus, and in Georgia in particular. So after the lecture, the director of a major museum, Georgia Museum, he jumped up and said, well, actually, it was she. She jumped up and said, take all our bones from our museums. Well, we want to know our history. We want to study it. Take all of them. And so, again, it's absolutely limitless, endless field of science. And we already have a number of projects. We have an Aryan project. We have a project of Rurik, which, you know.
Oh, yes, I know.
Supposed to be a first ruler of Rus, you mentioned. But it turned out he was not a Scandinavian because he don't have his mutations. And we have a Russian counts, a whole bunch of them, who supposedly are descendants of the Rurik. And indeed, all of them have very similar DNA.
Well, Anatoly, it's been a pleasure, and I hope that you maybe can come back and keep us posted if you do some more DNA testing and find some breakthrough evidence of something. Please let us know.
So, again, my pleasure indeed. All pleasure is mine, I should say. And you are a great, you know, host.
Super. Well, thank you so much.
No, thanks a lot.
You know, if we did come from Africa, then what's the problem if white people want to live there? Then what's the problem if we process the resources? After all, we're giving billions in aid to Africans. When first presented in 1987, the Out of Africa model was new, modern, and told humans about their distant origins. It even presented a biblical connection. This model was simple and made science reporting easy and fun. It implied the brotherhood of all humankind and was politically correct. It was idealistic and too good to be true. It is so popular because people want it to be true. In the end, the Out of Africa idea of human evolution is dominant among anthropologists, perhaps because most fossils were found there, because of the commitment to a single origin scenario, and finally because of cultural demands that all humans be of equal descent. While the Out of Africa model does incorporate certain fossil, genetic, and archaeological evidence, the same categories of evidence also prove the complete opposite. Yet if you read the evidence, the Out of Africa model is not a legitimate explanation for the emergence and subsequent spread of Homo sapiens. I'd encourage you to read Anatole's journal on this subject, as well as A Critique of the Out of Africa Model by Michael Maystad. I'm always shocked that some researchers can understand how history and science, is used for political purposes. But then they don't investigate further, questioning the mainstream account of what we've been told, still accepting the allowed version. What will it take for these men and women to break out of their boxes? Be sure to catch my interview next week with another Russian, Tuiliev Pavel, on Slavic mythology and paganism and Russia's new right political thought. До свидания, спасибо большое.